Welcome, everyone, and thanks for being with me this next hour. You are listening to the Friday Morning Show with C.A. Brooks on 1-2 Radio, where hopefully we are changing the way that we think about our experience in the world and the way we're spiritual beings in the world. Today is May 19th, 2017, and on today's show, we will be discussing A Course in Miracles with writer, web designer, and ACIM teacher Bruce Rawls. Now, our focus will come out of the ACIM, what's called the Manual for Teachers. You know, there's actually three books. We have a textbook, we have all of those lessons that come out of the workbook, and there is a manual for teachers. So we're going to talk about that today, and we're going to specifically be looking at what are the characteristics of God's teachers. That's what it's called. Now, the manual actually lists 10 different traits, including honesty, gentleness, joy, defenselessness, and open-mindedness. But the list starts with a really foundational quality, which is trust and how we develop trust. But before we get into this discussion, I want to preface it with a few comments. First of all, I love the Manual for Teachers, and I did start reading it relatively early. In fact, I think the first day I picked up A Course in Miracles, I was kind of, I was one of those students I wanted to check to the back page. So I looked at the workbook, I looked at the text, and I looked at the Manual for Teachers instead of thinking, okay, well, this is sequential. And I'm really glad that I did, because truthfully, I've always thought the Manual for Teachers was kind of a misnomer in that I automatically thought, oh, well, this is what you read this if you want to be a teacher of A Course in Miracles. That's what I thought. But of course, I quickly figured out, just like a lot of things in the course, no, they were reinterpreting the meaning. And so the Manual for Teachers is for everybody. It's easy to read. That's the other thing. Of all the books, it may be the easiest of all to read. However, I also think it's very, very easy to take what it says out of context if you're not also reading the textbook and or doing those workbook lessons. Because once again, we take those words, Manual for Teachers, Teachers of God, and we think we know what those mean. Well, we really don't if we're not paying attention to what the course is actually saying. So I would really warn you, if you want to just pick up that Manual for Teachers, make sure you're reading the text as well. Make sure you're not taking things out of context, because I think it's really easy to take this out of context, because it appeals maybe to the ego a little bit more, or to some of the concepts or the words that we know. So here again, a foundational piece that's so important, before you ever get anywhere near that Manual for Teachers, we are all teachers. That's what the course is telling us. We teach every moment of our lives. 24/7, we are teachers. And you know what we're doing? We're teaching and we're demonstrating what our belief system is. Always. So if we believe in separation, if we believe in ego, if we believe in pain or that life is hard and then you die, guess what we're teaching? That's what we're teaching in every single thing we do. That's what we're demonstrating. So when we're talking about teachers of God, we're literally saying, you know what? You always have a choice. There's two different paths here. And in fact, in the manual and in the course, they often call it like a ladder. So are you climbing the ladder of the ego, or are you climbing the ladder of God, Holy Spirit, Jesus, higher self, whatever you want to call it? And so as we go through this today, I want you to keep that in mind, that it's always about which ladder are you on? Which belief system are you wanting to choose? And this development of trust, as we first start out on these characteristics, that's one of the first thing that, that just keeps getting drilled in, is which choice are you making? Because that's always what's going on. Our first and only choice always is which voice are we going to listen to? And we, sometimes we're going along and we think we're listening to one voice and all of a sudden it switches, and we know that it just switched. We're listening to the ego again. So remember, we are all teachers. And when the manual says teacher of God, what they're really saying is the people that are choosing at this moment, are you choosing to demonstrate? Are you choosing to teach a belief because you're listening to the Holy Spirit? You're listening to your higher self. Or are you teaching the ego? But the teacher of God is just merely the person who says, this is the ladder I want. This is the path I want. I want to be listening to the voice inside of me that is not the ego. So just keep that in mind and, you know, try not to get distracted by that language. And as you're listening today, you know that you can always join us over on Facebook because we actually have a private group over there. And if you've never been over there, just go to our website, which is 12radio.com. And when you do, you're going to see on the left side, there's going to be a column. There is the word chat. If you click it, it will link you directly to Facebook. And if you're already a member, you know, you can just ask to join the group. You know, you do have to be a member of Facebook. I guess you have to have an account over there. But in any case, Scott Weaver is our producer today, and he's going to let you into that group where you can come in, you can make comments, you can ask questions. There's already a few people over there. Hey, thanks for being here, Mercy and Jan and Eva. Thanks for coming in, and I'm glad you're listening to us today. And if you want to make comments, you want to ask questions, I will try to keep an eye on that chat room while we're discussing today. So I want to get Bruce onto the show so that we can start talking about these characteristics, specifically trust, and what it takes to develop trust. So welcome, Bruce. Thanks for being here this morning.
Thank you, CA, and thank you, everyone, for contributing and participating and being part of this one thought system that we're learning to remember that that's all there is, isn't it? And I wanted to start off by you know, thanking you for a brilliant and a very eloquent introduction to the Manual for Teachers. I think you framed it beautifully because that you know that. Introduction really is, you know, puts it in the right perspective, and that context is so important because if we use, you know, particularly, you know, in the Western, you know, Judeo-Christian heritage that we, you know, even unconsciously, if we weren't part of that actively as you know, as younger people, we get that through our culture, and I think those words need to be redefined, you know, like teacher and God, and you know, that's why the glossary of terms in the back there is, you know, so important and why that's part of that supplemental material because we are redefining essentially a lot of things that have essentially by default, you know, the ego speaks first and is always wrong.
Right.
But our culture, not just, you know, formal religions, but our culture, really, is geared toward, the seemingly separate self and everything in this world really is a propaganda device, with, if we're not questioning and if we're not looking at it for that thought system. So really, another metaphor I like to use when I think of, you know, teaching is that if there's nobody out there, if this is a pure non-dualistic thought system and there's just one of us, then the only thing that really remains to be taught is my thoughts. And so the teacher of God is really, accepting my inner kindness teacher, and listening to the instructions that teacher within me, which is the same for all of us, truly, even though the form may be different, that speaks of the shared interest and the sameness that leads to the oneness and is a reminder that, if we look at our specialness and our victimhoods and all the grievances that take countless forms, the fears and the angers and crazy stuff, and look at those in the context of that inner kindness teacher, we really do have an opportunity to develop trust by just listening more and more carefully and more closely to that voice that's been with us all along, because that's really the awareness that we took with us into the dream that doesn't see a we and a they. There's no consciousness involved in the sense of a dualistic, you know, teacher and student kind of a thing. It's really, really just us undoing our belief in seemingly separate selves and the whole idea of separation, the whole idea of duality, which is what the, you know, as Ken Wapnick says, that we can't get too far from the metaphysics of the Course. And I think the way you prefaced this conversation this morning was perfect because it reminds us that this isn't our, you know, traditional, conventional use of the word teachers or God, mm-hmm. in the, you know, conventional formal religious sense. It's really, looking at, that spirit as being all inclusive and really undefinable because, you know, the self that we think we are has so constrained and so limited, the awareness that is our true nature that for the most part, you know, we're at the bottom of the ladder, as you, I like that metaphor too. But we have to make sure we're, as Ken Wapnick says, we're climbing up the right ladder. So I think that's where the trust comes in. So maybe we can, should we read some of that?
I want to say one more thing because you mentioned it. And I think once again, you know, my audience knows me. I'm just so particular, like, okay, just point me in the direction or tell me what I have to do. You know, what are the steps? And I'm very, very literal about it. And I think once again, it's so important not to be so literal, which is hard for me to do. I need to let go of that. But along the lines of separation and when every single time we choose to see our interests as the interests of other people. Every time we make that choice, then we're going to the ladder of the Holy Spirit.
Mm-hmm,
you know,
mm-hmm.
So it's not a matter of, oh, did I forget to wake up this morning and choose the right ladder? Did I say it right? Did I do the right incantation or do the right affirmation? No, it's like every single moment, you know, no matter where you are, the minute you're driving, you're in a line and you choose to see your interests as the same as other people's or vice versa. You choose to see that they want the same thing you do. They want to get out of the store quickly or they just want to feed their family or whatever it is. Every time that occurs to us that we're no different, that we all want the same thing, every time we do that, we have really grasped onto that ladder. We really have grasped onto that path. So I don't think we have to worry so much about, okay, you know, did I do it right? Which ladder am I on? We don't need to overanalyze that. We know we're on the wrong path every single time we feel upset and frustrated and angry and irritable. It's like, oops, we believed that we were separate and that, you know, it's a win-loser world. Every time we do that, then we know, oops, I need to switch paths, and we can do it just that quickly. So, yeah, okay, that's all I wanted to say.
And that's perfect because I was just going to share as you were saying, I was thinking, well, and another way of stating what you just said, which actually then you then proceeded to say was that it really is, you know, the feeling is the secret. Feeling is just noticing how you feel. And if it's not completely peaceful, then there's a little forgiveness classroom work to do, right? And that's, mm-hmm. that's the clue that we've, you know, we're heading up the wrong ladder again. It's like, we're not going to get anywhere because it gets, those rungs are going to get more and more rickety and it's going to get darker and darker the farther we try to climb out that imaginary ladder. But then, you know, the veils are lifted as we climb up the real ladder and we start to realize, wow, I really can feel peace when I see everyone in the same boat and we're all wanting to return to that remembrance of that shared self, that shared identity that really is complete and whole and innocent and pure and has nothing to do with these temporal selves that we've adopted and that really become our classroom for looking at the ways in which I thought we abandoned trust, but now we can return to that by seeing that every moment is an opportunity to deepen our level of trust.
Mm-hmm. And you know, I was just thinking as you were talking, in some ways it's unfair to even say that the ego has a ladder because it doesn't. I mean, all it has is a fun house.
You know,
it has this maze where we keep thinking we're making progress and we're never making progress. I mean, so it's a ladder to nowhere, but we're not making any progress at all. So we're not on a ladder. We're not evolving. We're not becoming enlightened. We're not going anywhere. We're just running around this. And like I said, I call it a fun house because that's what they call it at the, you know, recreational parks that, you know, it's a house of mirrors. You're just going round and round and round and trying to find the exit. And we keep kidding ourselves into thinking that we are finding the exit and we're just going round and round and round. It'll keep us in there forever.
Yeah, that's a good metaphor. And I was going to say it's a slimy, rickety hologram at best on a good day, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Of a ladder or a funhouse or whatever. Yeah. So yeah, exactly. And I think that, but we don't see that from the perspective of our normal everyday egoic selves, if you will, because we think this is the real deal. I mean, and if you talk to anybody on the street, typically when you ask, you know, what's real, they'll say, oh, well, this world is what's real. Well, That's because the propaganda is so popular, and we've all bought into it. But the shared interest, I think if we really look within our hearts and minds for the deeper connection and what we're really looking for, truly, that's when we, you know, come to realize that, well, you know, the things that change can't possibly be real. If reality and truth are aligned, then what's truly true couldn't possibly change. And I think that's where, you know, the foundation for our trust, has to reside. I'm looking at I have two monitors on my computer. I'm looking at a picture of Half Dome and Yosemite, which has been my screensaver for quite a few months. And, I'm thinking, well, the rock, you know, that we think of, that's solid, right? Well, it's all mostly empty space. It's really the atoms in each of those silicon dioxide molecules, of the granite anyway, on that massive piece of rock in a national park. That's why high energy particles not only can stream from outer space, can stream through the Half Dome, but out the planet and out the, you know, through the planet and out the other side without even slowing down if the energy is high enough, because there's really not much there to slow it down when you get to a high enough frequency. And I think that's kind of a metaphor for the idea that on a normal realm of thinking, we've slowed down or kind of deeper into the dream. We're in a level of awareness, a level of consciousness that is so far removed, at the bottom of the ladder, as Ken Wapnick would say, from the awareness that really transcends the seemingly separate self. We think this is the real deal. And I think it's important to acknowledge that, because that then becomes our classroom, and everything that seems to be an obstacle or a frustration or a grievance or a fear or twang, of guilt or whatever, those are all perfect classroom opportunities to look at and say, gee, okay, if I'm feeling this, if I'm sensing or experiencing something that isn't bringing me peace, that's where I can return to that inner kindness teacher and learn to trust that awareness that's within us all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So do you want to read part of this?
Sure.
Are you going to start with what are the characteristics of God's teachers? Is that the paragraph where you're going to start?
I was thinking we could, if we're going to make a series of this. I think that would be a really good place to start, because it puts the preface for the 10 characteristics that follow.
Right. So everybody, if you're following us, this is in the Manual for Teachers, and it's pretty close to the beginning of the book.
Yes.
Yes. It's called section number 4.
Right.
But it's pretty, it's just a few pages in, really.
Yeah. If you have a printed version, it's page 9 of the Manual for Teachers. But it's section 4. What are the characteristics of God's teachers? And it begins, the surface traits of God's teachers are not at all alike. They do not look alike to the body's eyes. They come from vastly different backgrounds. Their experiences the world vary greatly, and their superficial, quote, personalities, unquote, are quite distinct. Nor at the beginning stages of their functioning as teachers of God have they as yet acquired the deeper characteristics that will establish them as what they are. God gives special gifts to his teachers because they have a special role in his plan for atonement. Their specialness is, of course, only temporary, set in time as a means of leading out of time. That's a good one. Set in time as a means of leading out of time. These special gifts born in the holy relationship toward which the teaching learning situation is geared become characteristic of all teachers of God who have advanced in their own learning. In this respect, they are all alike. And just before we go further, I'd like to mention the word special is used here in an atypical way than it's used in much of the rest of the course, because here it's basically saying, because you think you're a seemingly separate self, you have a seemingly unique, in quotes, special function, because you have a seemingly unique path of forgiveness back through the undo process of undoing the dream, because your seeming circumstances are different than mine and everyone else's, and And so that's why, you know, the word special, I think, is used here, because it doesn't mean that it's better than or worse than. It just means it's uniquely tailored to this particular classroom that is optimized just with incredible beyond mathematical perfection for each of us, that so that, you know, what's in our unconscious mind is essentially projected out for us to look at and to see the truly insignificant, meaningless nature of all the seemingly separate things out of the context of the oneness, and at the same time learn to trust by seeing with real vision the interconnectedness, the relationship that everything has to each other, and everyone has to each other, that comes from the shared interest and you know, trusting that inner kindness teacher. To see that, you know, we're all here for the same purpose, is to return to the peace we never left.
Right. And, you know, and I'm glad you stopped there, because that's one of the lines in this paragraph that I think throws people. And how could it not throw you? It says, mm-hmm. God gives special gifts to his teachers because right. they have a special role in his plan for atonement. So if you are not careful, you go right out the window with that kind of a statement.
Yeah.
But if you keep reading, you realize it's very much what you were just saying. On one hand, yeah, you've got special gifts because you think you're special. You think right. you're different. And those are the very characteristics that will bring you back to the truth. But I think the other thing, and maybe I'm getting this wrong, but I think the other thing, and Ken Wapnick pointed this out in his, you know, book, you know, kind of a journey through the manual for teachers, which, by the way, Ken Wapnick, who is, you know, in my mind, a very respected teacher, has written a journey through the workbook, a journey through the text, a journey through the manual. So you can kind of, you know, go right along with him and read what he says about some of this stuff. But he talks about, yeah, God gave, you know, his teachers special gifts because that's who we are. As divine creatures, we have all these things naturally. And so once again, as we look at these characteristics, it's not something that we're getting. It's something we're uncovering.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was always there, and we just simply need to be reminded. So once again, don't look at that and go, oh, God gave special gifts to his teachers. You know, I wonder what my gift is, or this is obviously my gift. You're talking, well, you're
you
talking
can't have persona- it.
Well, you're talking personality there.
And that's it's what mine. You can't
appeals,
have it.
It appeals to the ego. It's like, oh, I was right all along. I do have special gifts. And I think, if you're not reading carefully, if you're not right. reading the text, you don't realize, yeah, they're special because everybody's got them.
Or, right.
What you're doing is you're finally, like I said, I think it's in two places, or it's two ways to think of it. It's, you know, because everybody's uncovering those very qualities and gifts in themselves. They were always there. You always had them. But I think the other meaning, you know, possible meaning of that sentence is, yeah, it's special because you've got to use your own personality. Just as you were just saying, you've got to use what you've got as your starting point for your curriculum. So, mm-hmm. of course, that's where you're starting, is where you think you're special. That's your curriculum. And nobody else has exactly the same curriculum.
Right.
Yes.
On the level of form, on the level of content, it's all right. identical, but that's seen from, you know, the top of the ladder, which where we're not, you know, typically at, right? So right. One final helpful thing that I found, your mileage may vary, but if anybody remembers the church lady skit from Saturday Night Live.
Oh, yeah.
Where he goes, well, isn't that special? When I see the word special, And I'm tempted to engage in ego's use of that word. I just kind of try to remember that little, you know, 3-second clip, and, you know, well, isn't that special? I'm just kind of, because it's silly. It's our specialness is really a parody of God's creation. And that, if we can remember to gently, not derisively, but gently, you know, in a kind-hearted way, laugh at all the things that we think are such big deals of our little stories and dramas and all the stuff that goes into our biographies and all the stuff that we think that we are, you know, and all it takes is a move, you know, to another house, which I did twice last year, to look at all the stuff and all the, you know, the belongings and all the baggage physically or anima and mentally that we carry around with us that we think this is my identity. And just look at that and say, all that specialness, all that stuff is really, one of two things. It's either a classroom for learning to forgive the meaninglessness of all those specifics and find the interconnectedness that is the real lesson behind it, the relationship, the shared interest that, that leads to, you know, the sameness that leads to the oneness, or it's a further, sabotage or propaganda that we've bought into from the ego that says, oh, I'm different, I'm better or worse, and you know, that whole comparative ethic kind of thing. So
right. Anyway, well, I'm glad you brought up the Saturday Night Live thing, because that's a great visual.
It is.
You know, that isn't that special, you know. Because it does, it makes you laugh like, oh my God, did I get off track or what?
Exactly. And I know we had a previous conversation with that, and on ACIM blog, I posted a picture of a clip of that video. So I'll link to it when I post this one. So.
Okay, great. That would
be
wonderful.
That's such a, it's like a 3-second clip. So
okay.
Do you want to read the next paragraph?
And sure. And there was one more line with there too, I think. I'm not sure we read it. All differences among the sons of God are temporary. Nevertheless, in time, it can be said that the advanced teachers of God have the following characteristics. Number one, trust. This is the foundation on which their ability to fulfill their function rests. Perception is the result of learning. In fact, perception is learning, because cause and effect are never separated. The teachers of God have trust in the world because they have learned it is not governed by the laws the world made up. It is governed by a power that is in them, but not of them. It is this power that keeps all things safe. It is through this power that the teachers of God look on a forgiven world. Now, once again, I remember reading that, and even sometimes when I reread it, it kind of throws me when it says the teachers of God have trust in the world. What do you mean we have trust in the world? Why would we trust the world? It's the illusion. But if you keep reading, what you're realizing, I think it's saying, is once again, the reason you trust your experience, or one of the reasons you can be okay, one of the reasons you can have peace, is because you're not allowing the world to give you the interpretation. You know there is another voice. There is another interpretation that is keeping you, quote unquote, safe. Once again, I'd be very careful about the way you use that word. Mm-hmm. But see, and I think as you're reading this, make sure you kind of keep reading, and that you don't get stuck on a particular sentence. Because like I said, I've gotten stuck on that one a number of times. Going,
yeah.
What is he talking about? I have trust in the world. But all, I have trust in what's going on because I have another teacher. I have another voice that will help me interpret what's going on. And then I really can see the world as the dream or illusion that it is.
Yeah. I, as you were saying that, I was thinking of another of Ken Wapnick's favorite metaphors, and that is, of course, as a grand symphonic, and he also uses the epic poem, but a grand symphonic masterpiece, and how it, you know, each theme builds on the other, and the themes are set aside to be repeated again later and tied together and integrated and all that kind of thing. And I think that fits in perfectly with what you're just saying, because the context that we get of understanding this is sort of like if you pull one note out of a song and just listen to that one note, it doesn't have the meaning of the whole, you know, the impact of the whole piece of music. And mm-hmm. I think that the same is true with the Course. And that's why going through it multiple times and repetition is so important, because every time you go through it, you know, for example, I just, you know, underscored the in and the of in that fifth sentence. You know, it is governed by a power that is in them but not of them. And I think that's, again, like what you're just saying, is that the world in itself isn't the thing we trust, but we trust that it will provide us the reflection of our unconscious mind as a perfect classroom to do our forgiveness work and to see that the things that we felt were our crimes against oneness are brought back to us in with mathematical precision, so that we can see anything that we feel in some inward level bad about can be brought to the altar of the mind, looked at with the Holy Spirit, and say, hey, you know, that thing that I was upset about or afraid of or angry or whatever about, seen in a different light, then becomes, you know, the holiest place on earth is where an ancient hatred has become a present love. So,
right. Yeah. Right. So, yeah, I'm going to continue with this paragraph and then you can take over the next. But okay. As we were talking about, because this is truly a continuation of that power to interpret the world, it says, when this power has once been experienced, it's impossible to trust one's own petty strength again. Who would attempt to fly with tiny wings of a sparrow when the mighty power of an eagle has been given him? And who would place his faith in the shabby offerings of the ego when the gifts of God are laid before him? What is it that induces them to make the shift? And so that's where Bruce is going to pick up. But see, once again, once you've tasted that power of interpretation, once you felt what it might be like to see something differently, you never want to go back. Now, the truth is we do go back. I mean, here again, you know, this climb that we think is very sequential isn't. You know, we all of a sudden realize all of a sudden we've gotten mad again. We've gotten frustrated. We've lost our perspective. But once we've tasted that power, once we've experienced it, we really always crave it again. You know, mm-hmm. we always want to mm-hmm. go back to that. And I think that's what it's saying. All of a sudden we realize we are using the power of the wings of the sparrow, and all of a sudden we know that there's something different. So what induces us to make the shift? You want to take it away?
Sure. And one more comment about the word power, which is yet another word that I think if the course is always and only about the mind, and it's really leading us to the all-inclusive thought system of pure non-dualistic oneness that is our true nature and our heritage, then the word power takes on a whole different meaning than it's usually used in our everyday world context, which is usually power over someone right. or something. And the power that the Course is talking about is power with. It's the power that includes everyone. It's the power that transcends anything we could possibly imagine, and as the sum of all the energy and mass and all the whole wattage of the whole universe, if you will, is really as nothing compared to the scope and the magnitude and the majesty of the mind of God, which is our true nature. That's not normally what we think about, but that's what I think the Course is trying to get us to remember. And that's why it's so important to develop that trust and as you're pointing out, when we lapse back into thinking that this little egoic self has something to offer, because we think, well, gee, I worked so hard making this up. There must be something here for me and in this little, shabby offering, but the more we look at it, honestly, the more the trust develops, because we see through the principle of contrast that the Course uses so dramatically, and really every section in the text, for example. It seems like it starts out with, a blatant expose of the flaws of the ego and how crazy and insane it is, and then presents us with the real alternative, which is the thought system of inclusion. And so we learn to trust that more and more when we realize that the separate interests really just leave us with a bad aftertaste. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the world to me, the ego's thought system is definitely the law of diminishing returns.
Absolutely.
And I think about that a lot. We don't have to look very far in our lives to just realize, just as simple as that first taste of ice cream is the best. But, you get
even if you only have one scoop.
Yeah, you just, as you keep going, how many people go, oh, this is better, and it's better, and it's better. And, it's because it's really not. I mean, the bodies that we've made, the world that we have made, for the most part, when we're in that ego thought system, it's always diminishing returns. Whereas once you shift, I think it does go the other way. There is that, we can gain that appreciation, that sense of peace in every single moment. And it does get better and better and better in terms of how we feel. Not necessarily in terms of what the world is doing. I'm sure our taste buds are still saying diminishing returns, diminishing returns. But the world, how long does it take us to learn, to learn that lesson? And we fight it. I mean, I fight it, and yet I know it consciously. This world is about diminishing returns. That's what happens.
Exactly.
So I want something better than that, Bruce.
Yeah, and I think the something better has to be developed, and I think that's why it's called the development of trust, because I think the more we look at the meaninglessness and the desolation of ego's propaganda and strategy and outcomes, and see that it is just a vast desert that we've made, through our, the ego's imagination, these oases, and once we get closer to the oases, they just disappear and realize, no, that's just desert too,
Mm-hmm.
And that was just a mirage. But what the reality is that when we are led by that inner kindness teacher, we realize that our relationship with everything that we encounter and everyone we encounter becomes a opportunity for the holy instant, because we see that we're in the same boat. We see that we have the shared interest. We can, relate with kindness and compassion, just as we have for ourselves to everyone. And then it becomes a more joyous experience. And then as it says, I think it's here also in the manual here, we begin to have, we smile more frequently, we begin to have a little bit more cheerful outlook, not on the world, but on where we're heading with respect to it. We're really developing a relationship with the true nature of each and every one that we meet, and not with what seems to be separate and different. We're able to look through the facade and see the true, glorious, beautiful, all of spirit nature in each person we meet. And that's what gives us the compassion and the strength to keep deepening that trust.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I just want to mention before we start into these six stages, there's a book by Anouk Sanchez and Tomas Vieira, and Tomas has passed on a few years ago, and they wrote this wonderful book called Take Me to Truth. And if you want to really get into these six stages, they have a whole book devoted to it, and it's quite good, and there's a lot of substance to it, and you might find it helpful.
Okay, thank you for that, because I'm not familiar with that book.
Oh, okay, yeah, it's an interesting book. I think they have cover some interesting ideas in it, and it's definitely worth a read if you're interested in looking at these six stages.
Okay, and did you say it's called Take Me to the Truth?
Take Me to Truth, uh huh.
Take Me to Truth. Okay, thank
yeah,
you.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. When Tomas was giving a workshop in Southern Oregon, he had an analogy I thought was really great that was sort of like the Holy Spirit is like the counterexample. He used the example of a GPS in the car is the Holy Spirit, where it the counterexample would be ego's version of a GPS would be, if you miss a turn, its GPS would say, "You jerk!
Right.
How could you have missed that exit?" But the Holy Spirit is basically, if we continue to trust that, just simply says, "Okay, well, you might have missed a little forgiveness opportunity there, but nothing happened. No harm was done to reality by our procrastination or our delay." It's needless, but not one's note in Heaven's song was missed, because that inner GPS that the Holy Spirit is just says, okay, well, here's the next exit.
Right, recalculating.
No condemnation. Recalculate. No condemnation. No judgment. So I've always liked that metaphor that Tomas had, I think of him and his great sense of humor when I think of that book the workshop that they gave. Anyway, I'll go ahead.
And that's a great analogy. Thank you for that GPS analogy.
Yeah, I think it is too. I think it is too. Do you want to read the first paragraph or?
Okay. First, they must go through what might be called a period of undoing. This need not be painful, but it usually is so experienced. And that kind of makes me laugh because it's like, okay, this isn't going to hurt much. Oh yeah. And I only say that because I think it is painful. I think for most of us, unless we're already pretty highly evolved somehow, it's going to be painful. So then it goes on to say, it seems as if things are being taken away, and it is rarely understood initially that their lack of value is merely being recognized. And I think that is so true. Stuff isn't leaving our lives. It, once again, it's diminishing rewards. All of a sudden, the things that used to make us happy, things that we used to think were so desirable, they're just not valuable. And that, so that period of undoing is when we're starting to recognize that some of the things in our lives just lack value. And when we recognize that, it doesn't feel good. Maybe that's where the pain comes in. So then continuing, it says, how can lack of value be perceived unless the perceiver is in a position where he must see things in a different light? He is not yet at a point at which he can make the shift entirely internally. And so the plan will sometimes call for changes in what seem to be external circumstances. These changes are always helpful. When the teacher of God has learned that much, he goes on to the second stage.
I think this might be a good place to tie into a similar section without reading it. There's, I think it's a little farther on here. It's, oh, here it is, page 26. Without reading, I think just we could have a brief commentary. This is section 9 in the manual. It says, are changes required in the life situation of God's teachers? And it says changes are required in the minds of God's teachers. And then it goes on to say, very rarely are physical behavioral changes necessary. Because it's, again, this is, of course, always and only about the mind. And so if that's the case, then the lack of value that is being asked to be recognized is the lack of value in the mind, and recognizing that our identity investment in situations and circumstances and having things be a certain way or not be a certain way, those are our investments in lack of peace. Which ties into my favorite phrase in the song of prayer, the secret of true prayer is to forget the things you think you need. Because that basically gives us a clue that if we're invested in a, you know, attached or averse to certain outcomes, you know, those are the seemingly external circumstances, that, you know, sometimes we can change them, but that's usually only effective when we've made the internal change first of recognizing that it doesn't matter what is or isn't appearing in the world, at least in the context of our peace, our identity. Now, on the level of form, it'd be silly to not do things we can do to make the world a, quote, better place. You know, and then, of course, doesn't argue against any kind of, you know, it's not about behavior, so it doesn't argue for or against any behavioral changes. But it does suggest that where we're really going to find lasting happiness, and that's where the trust comes in, is to uncover the beauty and the essence and the spirituality, if you will, that is within everything and everyone, and see what doesn't change as what is valuable, and so that what's valuable is things that couldn't possibly change, and we start to, the luster and the appeal and the seduction of things that can change suddenly, gradually, you know, diminishes over time. And I think that's, you know, addressed in this paragraph.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I wanted to give a couple of examples, and I've actually mentioned these before, so I'll do it very briefly.
Okay.
But one of my experiences when I first started reading the course is, you know, and I mean, I really grabbed onto it. I mean, I read it not day and night, but I read it every single day. I mean, it's like I could not get enough of it. And two different things did happen. One of them was, even though I was a practicing astrologer and I never completely let it go, I literally got rid of almost my entire library of astrology books, and I really cut back the amount of time I was doing it. And it had to do with the value. All of a sudden, it just didn't have the same value to me anymore. It wasn't my be-all and end-all. And, you know, it wasn't painful in terms of somebody said, okay, you've got to give up astrology. I just didn't care about it anymore. it wasn't important to me. And I literally, like I said, I gave away almost every single astrology book that I had, which I had quite the library because I had built it up for many years. The other thing that happened is I'd been a vegetarian for 19 years. And it all of a sudden occurred to me that I thought, you know what? I have made being a vegetarian a religious experience. You know, that's it. It has to be that way. Highly evolved people, of course, are vegetarians. Who would eat meat? And it, once again, in the context of the course, I thought, you know what? This is behavioral stuff. And you know, what happens if I eat meat? The world falls apart? What happens? And it's like those two things, you know, I just recognized how I had elevated them in my life and their value wasn't there anymore. So once again, I'm not telling people eat meat, don't eat meat, study astrology, don't study it. But those two things totally lost their elevated status and their importance to me. And it took about, and so I slowly started, you know, eating chicken. That's about it. I mean, chicken and a little turkey. So I never kind of fully went back because once again, I guess I didn't want to, but I had to challenge a belief system that, you know, there was this black line and I was on one side of it. And then of course, within a year, I started doing a lot more astrology again and I started buying a few more books. And you know why though? What I recognized by that point, I was through the course in terms of reading the whole thing and I realized this isn't about behavior. And it's like, I choose to do what's fun. I choose to do what I love to do, but I love astrology. I think astrology is a great explanation for, you know, in the dream world and in the illusion. But I don't think I'll ever get confused again in thinking that it truly explains life in the same way that I think the course does.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but for me, you know, it, like I said, nobody made me give those things up, but they truly did they lost their value.
Yeah, yeah. I kind of think of it as, because I have a similar interest in what's become known as sacred geometry, and I've written a book or two on it, it's not that that interest has waned. In fact, it's increased, you know, maybe arithmetically, but my interest in A Course in Miracles and really applying that and seeing that as a more front and center part of my spiritual path, if you will, has become accelerating geometrically. And so I actually still have a lot of fun with the geometric stuff, but the course has become really more of a front and center kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. One last comment on the diet thing. I think as long as, you know, since, you know, vegetarians eat vegetables, I think we're probably okay as long as humanitarians don't start eating humans, and then we're probably fine, right?
That's right. That's right. Well, and I was thinking there was one more thing. What was it that was along these lines? And in fact, actually, I'm looking at the clock and, you know, maybe we should just finish this discussion and going on to the next stage, which is the period of sorting out next
yes.
time that we talk.
Because, okay.
You know, here again, it would be really nice for me to go, okay, I went through that first stage and I'm done. But no, it's always a continuation of establishing value and recognizing what doesn't have value. And
exactly.
I remember what I was going to say. It also always reminds me when I think back about the astrology and the vegetarianism, et cetera, it's kind of like movies. And what I mean by that is, you know, we are aware of the fact that we're watching special effects,
mm-hmm.
but we still go to movies. It's
yeah.
not like we go, okay, I get it. It's not real. So I'm not going to watch it anymore. And I think that's where I came to with the astrology or the vegetarianism or anything else is just because I now understand that it's a special effect or that it's an illusion. It doesn't mean it's not fun. It doesn't
yeah.
mean I don't enjoy it. And it doesn't mean it shouldn't be part of my life. It just has a different place in the same way that movies have a place in our life.
Mm-hmm.
We don't substitute movies for our reality.
Right.
Unless, of course, we're Pisces, and then we do that.
Yeah, I think there's, the phrase that comes to mind when watching movies is, especially when you mention special effects and all the Hollywood technology that, you know, goes into the CGI stuff, computer-generated imagery.
Computer, yeah.
Yeah, I was thinking, well, the suspension of disbelief is really something we apply to going to a movie, but we forget to apply it to our so-called
yeah.
everyday reality, you know?
Right.
And I think that's a, maybe I'll make a little placard or fridge magnet or something. But you know, the suspension of disbelief is something that is applicable 24/7. You know, from the time we get out of bed in the morning to the time we turn in. And if we can, you know, not necessarily have it, you know, burned into our retinas or anything, but just kind of remember that it's like, I could suspend my belief, in this as being all there is. You know, I could learn to see that these external circumstances that seem to be are really just a classroom for me to see that this is a hologram of projected ideas from my unconscious mind that is really a forgiveness classroom, that if I see it within that lighthearted context, I can learn to not take it so seriously. And as you're pointing out, I can actually have more fun with the things that I do in the world, in this dream, and enjoy them more. And why not? I mean, it doesn't mean that you don't give them the same amount of effort or attention or labors of love kind of thing, but just you're not as attached to the outcomes.
Right.
And you don't have the aversion to, oh, well, what if this, you know, doesn't happen, or what if this does, kind of thing. It's just like, okay, well, that again becomes part of the classroom.
Right. And, you know, I'm thinking, what if we could do that? Go, oh, well, this movie kind of sucks. <You know? laughs> I wonder if I could change a channel, or I wonder what I could do differently. Cause boy, this movie isn't any fun. You know, if we could just take that step back, and we can,
we can take
that step back and suspend belief in the same way with the movie, and yet go to the movie and really, really enjoy it. You know, be in there, but never believe that it's us. Never believe that it's our only truth and who we are.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I don't think the course is asking us to abandon the identity we work so hard to make. It's basically just asking us to question. It just says, "Is this what you really want?" And with some of those you know, probing questions, like, you know, would I accuse myself of this when we want to look at our projections that we have negative interpretations of, and we see, you know, whether it's a politician on TV or a lobbyist or a person cutting us off on the freeway, or a family member doing something that we wish they wouldn't do, or, you know, it could be any number of things. Or we watch ourselves doing something that's like out of habits, like, well, that was dumb. Why did I do that again? and just, you know, if we can just learn to see that those are robotic actions, that we're not going to change the mechanics, but we can change how we interpret. And I think that's, you know, it's how we look at each other, not the photons that hit our retinas, but it's the interpretation. Whether we use Holy Spirit's interpretation or egos, that determines whether or not we're at peace. And that's
right.
I think that's the changes that are helpful.
Yes.
The changes in what seem to be external circumstances really are just reflections of the changes in the mind. And that's why that first stage of the development trust, as you were pointing out, really is something that we go through all these changes. And this isn't a linear process. Another thing important to, you know, preface this ongoing series of conversations about is that all of these things, we go through all of these stages, you know, all the time, and we shift around to where some are predominant. I'm sure as an astrologer, you know that, you know, there's things that archetypally are more predominant through different times of the year or different times of the day. And certainly for individuals with different astrological makeup, to they have different challenges and you know, shortcomings and strengths and that sort of thing that can be brought to bear. But all those things are just parts of the classroom of looking to see that ultimately the differences can dissolve in the oneness that we all share.
Yes. And Bruce, thank you so much. I am so glad we're doing this particular series. And as Bruce said, I think there are 6 different stages to the development of trust. So when we get back together, we're going to talk about the next one. So I would encourage you, if you're interested, go to the Manual for Teachers and read this. I think you can find it online.
Oh, yes.
But okay. Yeah. Great. You can find it online. So if you even don't have a book, you can go read it. And by the way, Bruce is going to be back on Friday, the 2nd of June. So it's only going to be a couple of weeks from now when Bruce is going to come back, and we will start going through those additional stages. So Bruce, we have about 1 minute to wrap up. Anything that you want to say in that minute?
Well, I always like to remind people that we have these conversations when I get the audios up on ACIMblog.com, as well as conversations with folks like Bob Rosenthal and Susan Dugan, Jackie Laura Jones, Lynn Johnson, who I talk to every Saturday morning, usually about the Course in Miracles on ACIM Gather, and lots of things like that, and also links to other resources. And I try to encourage people also to go to the two main sites, which are acim.org and facim.org, which are the websites of the sister organizations for the Foundation for Inner Peace and the Foundation for A Course in Miracles, which are the two sister organizations that are carrying on the work of Helen and Bill and all that they've given to our world.
Thank you for that.
Thank you.
And by the way, I did just post your ACIM blog in the chat room. And everybody, thank you for being over in the chat room today. And everybody that's listening, whether you're listening live or encore, thank you so much for being here today. And also thanks to Scott Weaver, our producer. And to everybody else, I guess I just want to say thanks. And remember that the sun is leaving Taurus today, and it's going to move into Gemini tomorrow. So we're having a special sale on Want to Listen. You can find me later this afternoon and this evening that way. And I hope that you will stay tuned. And because up next, there's a lot of live programming here on One Two Radio. So until next week, relax and wear loose clothes. You have been listening to the Friday Morning Show with C.A. Brooks and my guest, Bruce Rawls, on One Two Radio, where we are changing the way you think about trust.